Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Barbara Jaffe, and we're going to be talking about her newly released memoir, When Will I Be Good Enough? When Will I Be Good Enough is the first memoir focused on the emotional issues of the replacement child syndrome by a replacement child. Having written this book, Barbara looks forward to helping others pursue a full and honorable life, one they can pass on to their children and then to future generations. While the circumstances of her birth reflect her position as the replacement child, today she chooses to view herself as the unique individual she is, a replacement child no more. Barbara Jaffe is an award-winning English professor at El Camino College, California, and is a fellow in UCLA's Department of Education. She has offered countless workshops to students to help them find their writer's voices through writing nonfiction. Her college has honored her by naming her Outstanding Woman of the Year and Distinguished Teacher of the Year. Her wish for this book is twofold. First, to help other replacement children understand and accept their often challenging journeys as she reveals her own. Second, to offer a cautionary tale to parents who have, perhaps unwittingly, set the stage in their own families for a child who serves as a replacement for another who is viewed as less than by comparison. Barbara also shares her inner journey to wholeness, so that readers may be able to relate to their own challenges and growth, whether they are replacement children or feel less than at times. So with that, I'd like to welcome Barbara to the show. Good day, Barbara.
Hello. Thank you so much for inviting me on the show, Robert.
It is my pleasure. In October, I had my six-year anniversary, and I was recapping the previous year's books, and memoirs were the number one top subject that I had, for the previous year. So, and I have to admit, memoir of the replacement child syndrome was not on that list. So I'm glad to have that on my list now.
Thank you so much. I think a lot of us want to tell our stories, right, to help others.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I guess, first of all, let's start with what is the replacement child syndrome. Before I received the information from your publicist, I really didn't know much about it. So if you wouldn't mind, would you share with our listeners
Sure. What
it is? And is this something that you kind of that has defined you, for most of your life?
Okay, so actually it hasn't really defined me, and I didn't really even think too much about being a replacement child other than knowing that I was born after my brother Jeffrey died. But so I started to write my truth. I wrote a story that turned into more pages that eventually turned into the book. And when I was done, I decided on a title, and I came up with the idea of a replacement child because that's really what I was. I had no idea that there was research out there, limited but still research, and I started to Google replacement child. And the first thing I found was Judy Mandel's book, which was titled Replacement Child, a very good book. It was the first book that was written about the experience. There was a paper written by Albert and Barbara Kane in 1964, which really was the first. It was just a couple pages about the idea of a replacement child and the fact that if the parents do not learn to deal with their grief and walk through the steps, it can affect the subsequent children. And then Dr. Abigail Brenner, psychiatrist, came out with research recently, a wonderful book of which she interviewed me for, on a replacement child, replacement children, silent scripts, I believe it's called. And it's it deals with the replacement child syndrome. She wrote a paper for Psychology Today on the replacement child syndrome. And often children that are replacement children are anxious. They're perfectionists. But all of these qualities are something that we can have without being a replacement child. So it wasn't until after I actually did my writing where I found that there was more information. And I think it was a better idea because I think I would have been a little bit intimidated if I did it the other way around.
Yeah, well, you know, it is good that you the way that you did it, expressing your memoir, you know, and then, you know, finding out that, you know, this, you know, this syndrome or this particular, you know, position in the family really is something that exists, and it does create, you know, sometimes, you know, additional challenges for children, you know, who aren't viewed as replacements. But so with the replacement child, it's generally considered when a child is either conceived or born after the loss of another child, correct?
Right. The child is intentionally conceived and born to replace the child that perhaps maybe their family would have been complete otherwise. In this instance, I have an older brother who's almost 7 years older. His name is Stephen, and then Jeffrey was born, and then Jeffrey died. So I was born to replace Jeffrey.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, I believe it was in your book I started reading, it seems that whenever parents experienced the loss of a child, that it wasn't uncommon for doctors or even, you know, people within their circle to suggest that the parents conceive and basically bring in another child. So in a way, it's kind of like setting the stage for a replacement child.
Yes, and in those days, therapy or support groups for parents who've lost children were not that common in the 1950s, and in fact, kind of maybe therapy was kind of looked down upon. And my mother, you know, very sadly was in bed, very upset, clearly and obviously, and the doctor paid her a house call, and the therapy that she got was a slap across the face, literally, and said, get on with your life, move on, have another child. You already have one, have another. And that was really her therapy. I remember her telling me once when I was older, she said, that's what the doctor did, and that was my therapy. And, you know, that's tragic.
Yeah, it is. Now, and I know this was in your book, there was at times that you were told that if Jeffrey had lived, then you wouldn't have been born. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah.
And
it seems to me that would be a heavy load for a child, you know?
Yeah, I think I got very good early on reading between the lines because, you know, if Jeffrey had lived, you wouldn't have been born. I think, okay. But then as I got older, I kind of finished the sentence. Well, then, you know, I am the replacement child, and what did I do to poor Jeffrey? You know, I had a little bit of those thoughts.
Yeah, it's one of the things that when I was reading up about the replacement child syndrome, and you know, reference, I think there were a couple articles online from the psychologist that you mentioned, is that the part of that unresolved parental grief, you know, is fear, carrying over fears and guilt, you know, to the children, and it seems that, you know, that, you know, maybe unintentionally or unwittingly, that may sometimes, be, you know, kind of passed on to the children or at least, you know, give the children the indication that they're, you know, they should maybe feel guilt, you know, because of being a replacement child.
Right. And, you know, and I feel very sad for my mother that she had to experience that. Absolutely. Yeah, Dr. Abigail Brenner, the psychiatrist, the one who is the one you referenced in the articles. And it's fascinating that there are these qualities of replacement child syndrome. But and I fit most all of them, which is very fascinating.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, you know, and one of the, you know, you mentioned, you know, that some of those characteristics, you know, can occur without being a replacement child. And but the parents having an overprotective and maybe sometimes, you know, restrictive type of feeling, you know, toward, you know, the replacement child, that, you know, that in itself can, I guess, they call it now, helicopter mothers.
Oh, the helicopter,
you know,
the parent,
kind of,
right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. That would kind of create,
yes,
that an anxiousness in the child.
Yes, and I think that in my mom's case, I could understand when I was not feeling well, when I got ill, this is when she really, really fell apart. And I can understand that. You know, she probably was thinking,
mm-hmm,
oh, I don't want to lose another child. So there were many times when I felt sick that I didn't even tell her. I just tried to hide it because I knew it would really upset her. And, you know, as a young child growing up, what I wanted to do more than anything was to make her happy. That seemed to be,
yeah,
my goal in the house.
Yeah, yeah, very much. So now, what, you know, your brother Jeffrey died, I believe it was a little before he was almost two. That correct?
That's right. Uh huh.
Yeah. So when you reached that age, you know, that particular age of when Jeffrey died, do you have any recollection of, you know, your parents' behavior? You know, maybe, you know, because you've kind of reached that age and now gone beyond it, or have you, in discussions afterwards with, you know, your older brother, you know, was there any kind of recognition that you got to that point and beyond?
Well, you know, first, it's fascinating. My older brother, Stephen, has no memory of Jeffrey, and he was 5 and a half at the time.
Oh.
So, I find that to be really fascinating. He doesn't even remember the turmoil around his death, where maybe he, you know, was staying at my grandparents' house or anything like that, which I thought was really interesting. I don't have many memories of going back to, but what I do remember is that whenever I needed anything at night or in the middle of the night when I woke up as a little girl, I always called my father. It was my father who came in. My father had told me in retrospect he got up every night and fed me a bottle when I was an infant. So it really was he that was taking care of me. And that's an imprint that I had growing up until actually I left home, was always, you know, calling my father for things.
Yeah, wow. So, you know, if you were to say that there were, you know, any particular areas of your life that, you know, were affected most by being a replacement child, what would they be?
Many of them, actually. I'd say for me, the big ticket items were marriage, having children, a career. Those are huge. I didn't really have any problems making decisions to get married, to have children, to want to work. But I always felt as if I was a salmon swimming upstream or walking through quicksand, that everything seemed so much harder for me. And, of course, this is my perception. Other people might have looked at me and said, oh, you know, she has it all together. But I felt it didn't have to be this hard. I had a lot of difficulty in making decisions once I became a mother. I had good common sense, but what was the best that I need? I wanted someone to tell me what to do. I wanted someone to tell me what to do when we got married. I wanted the guidance from my mother in all areas of my life, which I didn't have.
Okay. Well,
I did
now,
it was just hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and that feeling of swimming upstream, you know, one of the things that, you know, that I read about is that sometimes there's a like a halo effect of the child that was lost and mm-hmm. trying to live up to that lost child's the expectations the parents may have had, you know, for that child. And it's, do you think that maybe that may have created some of that feeling of having to struggle to kind of meet expectations or to, you know, to get some of the basics accomplished?
I never really felt that I was in competition with Jeffrey because he died, you know, when he was so young. And also my mother kind of reinforced the idea that she wanted a daughter, so it was nice that, you know, I was a female. But I got mixed messages. We weren't allowed to talk about Jeffrey at all. I really couldn't ask questions. And so a lot of the answers to the questions that you ask kind of are just, I don't know, they're muddied. I don't really have a specific memory of being compared, which I guess is a good thing. But I always sense my mother's depression and sadness over this. And when I would say things, you know, she'd say, "You think you have problems. You don't understand what problems are and how difficult life can be." And I always felt, well, yeah, I guess I don't deserve to be upset about such and such. And those are the kinds of things that trickled into my everyday life. But I don't remember being compared to Jeffrey, but I do remember pictures around the house. And, you know, inquisitively, I'd say, "Who was that?" And and she didn't really, that's Jeffrey, but she didn't really want to talk about it. So a lot of things left me unsaid.
Yeah. You know that's, I mean, that's interesting because, you know, in some cases I could see where, you know, there is that, you know, the avoidance. If we don't talk about it, we don't feel, you know, the hurt, the loss, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm sure there's probably occasions where, you know, some parents, you know, talk a lot about it. Your parents, basically the response that your parents had to Jeffrey's death, they were different, correct?
Right. My mother didn't want to talk about it. She never wanted to look at old pictures or movies. My father would answer any question that I had. He wanted to talk about Jeffrey. He showed me his baby book. He showed my husband and I old films that he had taken. So I think, you know, he worked through it pretty well. But my mother never did.
Yeah. So Do you think that the basic idea of working through the grief is what, you know, is key in order to, you know, in being able to handle, you know, the loss? So, you know, with your father's handling it, talking about it, and your mother not talking about it, do you feel that maybe she just didn't go through the grief process thoroughly to be able to, you know, get to the point of being able to talk about Jeffrey?
I think so. I really do. I think that if she had talked about it or even, you know, had gotten support, medical support, anything, it would have been very helpful. She didn't talk about it with her own parents, really. She didn't talk about it with my father. She didn't talk about it with us. And my father just, you know, he wanted to process it, and he wanted to talk about Jeffrey. And I think that's really sad. So consequently, I grew up wanting to talk about everything. I wanted to search. I took a journey, you know, of introspection. I wanted to find answers to everything. And I think in a lot of ways it frightened my mother. You know, why would I want to do anything like that? Why would I want to find out more information? And it, you know, that was a difficult kind of interaction between us. She just couldn't understand why I decided to take this journey of, you know, internal journey. We were different that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, you know, it's one of those things where I would think, you know, as a child, when you have parents that react so differently to, you know, one event, you know, in life, that to me it seems like it would be, you know, that childhood curiosity of, you know, why the difference, you know, and you know, what is it you know, what is it that I'm missing? You know, that, you know, trying to understand. You know, obviously you said, you know, your mother wasn't the one who kind of did the feedings, you know, after your father told you in retrospect, but, you know, to get up and do that. But, you know, the idea of, you know, why is it my mother doesn't talk about Jeffrey and why is it my father does, you know, who is Jeffrey, you know, and how does he fit into this picture? How do I fit into this picture?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Very interesting. I mean, I know my mother did the best she could, and I know that she loved me as best as she could, but it was conditional.
Well, that's, you know. Now, one of the things, too, that I recognized in Abigail's article about replacement baby syndrome is that, you know, often there might be kind of a, you know, the child feeling of guilt or survivor's guilt of a sort, you know. So, you know, in that particular, you said that, you know, you feel that, correct? I mean, you didn't have any of that kind of thing at all as you were growing up?
Well, what I felt was that I wanted to make my mother's life as easy as possible, and I wanted to make her happy, and I didn't want to add to any of her burdens. And so that was the, when I would be like a bad little girl or do something that wasn't right and she got upset, that's when I started to feel guilty. I shouldn't add more on her plate. I just wanted to keep things so everything was fine and easy in the house. That's really how that guilt manifests itself.
Okay. Now, I read it early in the book, you talked about your mother, you know, being in bed a lot and you know, processing the fact that, you know, someone who's in bed is sick and she didn't necessarily have the physical symptoms, you know, that, you know, people, but that it affected you in the way that you kind of went the other way. You wanted to live life fully, you know, and not be in bed. Is that correct?
Absolutely. To the other extreme, where I sometimes see myself as a metaphor, like the brooms in Fantasia. You know, they keep multiplying, and I can't stop. Although when I was younger, I didn't really think it was unusual to have a mother that was in bed a lot. I just figured, well, that's what moms do. Until I, you know, would visit other homes, or as I grew older, I really saw that that's not what moms do, that they don't spend a huge amount of time in bed. And that when I would come home from school, my grandmother was the one that greeted me. My mother was in bed. My grandmother helped me get a snack or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. My mother did a lot from her bed. I mean, she would help me with my schoolwork in terms of testing me, things like that. But I think it left such an imprint on me that even when I'm sick, I won't go to bed. I mean, I have to be like hospital, you know, a type of sick in order to stay in bed. So that's the other extreme, where I just keep going and going, and I have to literally tell myself it's okay to sit down, it's okay to lie down. When I was doing a lot, because that's just the kind of personality I am, I just have a lot of irons in the fire, and I like to have that full life. My mother would often say, "You're doing too much. I don't understand." And it was the complete opposite, rather than, you know, some parents will say, "That's so great that you're doing so many different, you know, things. Your life is full." It was the opposite for her. So I went the other way. I really did.
Wow. You know, see, that's the one thing that I found interesting, you know, in reading up about the replacement child syndrome. There's, you know, with the challenges, you know, that it can create as far as expectations, you know, fear, possible fear, guilt, those kinds of things that are possible, but also the fact that it seems that it would also create in the child a drive, an internal force that maybe, you know, wouldn't have been there if, you know, the child didn't die. You know what I mean? It seems that there's good aspects as well to this.
And that's really what I focus on in my book, you know, the inspiration part of it, that I like to look at it as I've taken myself and literally taken myself apart into pieces and then put myself back together in a magnificent tapestry that I couldn't have done had I not experienced this. And I think we all have challenges in our lives, and it's really our perceptions and how we can put ourselves back together and live more fully. And that's how I see it. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, we're about halfway through the show, so I do want to invite callers. If you have any questions you would like to ask Barbara, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in, and we will get to them after the break. And then when we come back from the break, Barbara, we've been talking about replacement children, you know, in the syndrome. I would like, when we come back, if we can talk a little bit about, siblings and maybe those cases where it isn't the textbook definition of replacement child syndrome, but maybe some of the issues. So anyway, how this particular book would resonate with those who aren't in the strictest sense of the word replacement children. Okay?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone. Thank you for staying with us again today. My very special guest is Barbara Jaffe, and we've been talking about her book, When Will I Be Good Enough? A Replacement Child's Journey to Healing. And you can find out more about Barbara and her book by visiting her website, which is barbaraannjaffe.com. And that's BarbaraAnnJaffe.com, and I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back.
Hello.
Oh, hello. Okay, great. We're back, and definitely want people to go ahead and look at your website, because, you know, in addition to having information and resources, you also have a blog there. So it would be great reference material for people to go and check out.
Great. And also a link to my Psychology Today articles that I've been writing.
Oh, very good. Boy, I love Psychology Today. Ever since I was got my bachelor's in psychology from Whittier, and that's when I became.
Oh, okay.
I became attached to Psychology Today.
They read my book, and then they asked me to blog for them, so I'm a regular blogger for them.
Very good. And that's great. So now, talking about your book in as far as replacement children. So, does your book? How does it apply to people who may not necessarily fit into that strict definition of being a replacement child?
Yes, I think that children who've been raised by an alcoholic parent, a depressed parent, a detached parent, an abusive parent, I think children that are that perhaps come from blended families, there's half siblings, adopted, these are all issues that unless communication is available and parents and children can really talk through, that children can grow up in an isolated format, and a lot of the qualities that had been indicated in the research for replacement children can also be attributed to them as well. So those are all areas where I think my book, specifically in the areas of self-confidence, self-esteem, self-worth, are sometimes compromised, as they were with me.
Yeah, that's very much, and there doesn't have to be that loss of a child and family, and quite often, in families who have children who are chronically ill, sometimes, that illness can generate the feelings of a loss, because it's, as parents, I'm sure from the time the child is born, you have expectations that, that which your child is going to grow up to be, going to their wedding, have their kids, there's certain things that, as a parent from the time that they're born, that you have these hopes and dreams that your child will achieve. And if life hands a curveball and that then sometimes it can be felt as a loss.
Yes, I think that what you brought up, the idea of expectations, which I write about in my book, that expectations really are planned disappointments, that we have to kind of recalibrate. I kind of call it a Kodak image of what we really want it to be and then the reality of the situation. And that's okay. We just have to, limit our expectations. I think that you actually spoke about that, too, in an interview that you had with Elizabeth Hamilton Garano, right? In terms of expectations.
Yes. I've really, when it comes time to expectations, I've really taken a close look at that. And, quite so often where I would, have these lofty expectations, I like your phrase, planned disappointments, because it's, whenever you, whatever you create as far as an expectation, it can either not live up to what it is that you envision, or you also could possibly limit to something beyond, that's
I worked really hard at limiting those. Absolutely.
Me too. Okay. So now, one of the things that you mentioned, when it comes to these communication issues and how it can relate to, people who have could create self-esteem issues. In what ways, body image is a big topic nowadays. Right now, there are unfortunately some young girls who are obsessed, with body image. And so how does that view of self, body, the body, one's body, kind of play into some of the consequences of being either a replacement child or, having that, some of the impact of what one would be?
Yes, it certainly was for me, the idea of not being thin enough, not being good enough, manifested itself in an eating disorder before I hit puberty. I was really chubby, and that was in the day where still today the idea of Twiggy, the very thin model, and I just loved food, and my mother very early on told me that I really should watch it, that I had, she was probably protecting me for what was to come, as a maybe chubby female growing up in the 60s and body image and everything. But because of my perfectionist nature and because of my feeling of guilt in so many ways, I think I internalized that along with my mother's strength in, you know, a heavy arm in raising me, that was the way I sought control of myself, and that was through my eating disorder. And I think it can manifest itself in various ways for different people. It could be, you know, through drugs or alcohol or any other extreme, but for me it was just anorexia, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. You know, that's the one thing that, you know, when I've had so many guests, you know, and talking about, you know, about parenting and you know, body image, self-esteem. And the one thing that just kind of grates on my nerves is when I'm out in public and, you know, and I see a parent, you know, belittle or ridicule a child for, you know, a weight issue or even just, you know, being condescending, you know, in some, you know, way, shape, or form. And you know, and it's, to me, I myself personally have had to deal with, you know, rewriting those tapes, you know, that are kind of been ingrained, you know, from childhood. And I just think that it's so incumbent on parents to recognize the power of their words and actions, you know, when it comes to empowering their children to be happy, healthy adults.
Oh, absolutely. Not to be defined by the way we look, whether it's beauty or weight. And my brother did not have those issues. You know, they pretty much let him do whatever he wanted. He could eat whatever he wanted. But for me, and my father was very much did not want to talk about weight and just wanted me to be happy and healthy and not worry about it. But my mother was very worried about it. And that became my focus. And it became a battle between us probably for the rest of our lives. At one point, she thought I was too thin. So, I mean, it just played out.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems very much a gender difference in the perspective. I mean, you know, that I don't know because I'm not a woman, you know, but it seems that women are just very, that it's very important. It seems to be, I mean, obviously things have shifted from the 50s and 60s. You know, thank goodness, but it still seems is that we have a long way to go because there's, again, you know, when I see, you know, the emphasis that young girls are putting on, you know, their weight and seeing cyberbullying, you know, of young girls because of their looks or just who they are. I mean, to me, it's just very sad that we're, you know,
absolutely,
we're at that point where that we can't look beyond the physical.
Fortunately, my mother was also, it was very important that I was a nice person and a good person, and she emphasized that a lot. So it wasn't just looks. But what's sad today is that the research shows that a lot of men, a lot of teenage boys and young men have eating disorders, in much the same reason, you know, the idea of the six pack and the exercising and the vitamins and all the protein powders, it's really affecting the male population now too.
Yeah. We've really become a shell of society in some ways, you know, and it's, you know, hopefully, you know, we can just through attention, you know, create a sea change. I mean, this is one of those things that it takes generations to shift, you know. It's not something that can certainly happen overnight.
Absolutely, that's true.
Yeah. So now, having, you know, being a replacement child, and, you know, you talked about one of the challenges that it created for you personally, besides the marriage and career, was children. So how did your being a replacement child affect your parenting of your children?
Well, I can start with my first child being born, and I did everything that I thought I was supposed to. I took the Lamaze classes in those days, and I did, you know, breastfeeding classes, whatever, and my baby was born, and I had to have surgery, so it was a little bit harder to recover, and I didn't have any understanding of how to breastfeed, and I just couldn't do it effectively, and I didn't have any support in terms of a nurse coming in or in terms of my mother for help or anyone really. And I just thought that I immediately had flunked that. I couldn't even do that, you know, not knowing that I'm sure other new mothers would feel the same way of being inadequate. Mm-hmm. But when I felt inadequate, I just felt, okay, I wasn't a good mother. And so I decided that I wouldn't breastfeed. And then feeling guilty, I changed it to bottle feed. Finally, the card with the baby in the isolate little nursery area looked like a scorecard, crossed out, crossed out, crossed out. Finally, the pediatrician comes in and says, you're going to have to make a decision. Either way, your baby will be healthy. You choose, but you're driving the nurses crazy. And that's really kind of a metaphor for how I just tackled motherhood, you know, making a decision. I was really making a decision. I just did not know what to do, or I thought I didn't know what to do. And if I just let myself alone, and I had good, as I said, common sense, and I loved my children, everything else would follow. But I so wanted to do everything perfectly that I just kept beating myself up about it. Once I let go and say, okay, I'll be okay feeding him a bottle, and he was healthy and thriving and fine, it was okay. And I pretty much did that with a lot of areas of motherhood, you know, in school, in choosing a nursery school, in whether my children misbehaved. I figured it had a direct reaction as implication of what kind of parent I was. And that, I mean, in all areas. And it took me a long time to realize that other mothers and fathers feel the same way. But I just didn't know that.
Yeah. So the idea, first of all, of that feeling less than,
right,
then created the desire for perfection to do it right. Is that correct? And then
yes,
you know,
and also
because it seems, I'm sorry, it was to say, because it seems like, you know, that the not making a decision, you know, and wanting to do it perfectly, you know, kind of is an answer to that feeling less than, that I am, you know, I can do it. I can do it right, whatever that is,
right.
Whatever right
and
is.
And I totally believed that other young mothers knew more of what to do than me. And I used to remind myself, I used to play with dolls. I really thought that I had this down. But when the baby came and the baby wasn't just sleeping in my arms and might have been crying or needing something, but that's what babies did, but I didn't know it. And I just needed someone to tell me, you're fine, everything will be okay. And I didn't have that. But eventually, I became the voice that I needed to hear. And I think that's where everything changed for me.
Yeah. Now, do you think that, you know, with the first especially, that the, you know, the fact that your mother, you know, was not, you know, that responsive when you were very young, you know, that imprinting maybe contributed a little bit into the questioning of what is a mother to do?
I think so, and I do remember saying to her as a new mother, I just don't know what to do, and she goes, I can't help you. I don't know what's wrong with you.
Oh, wow.
Kind of putting it back
wow.
on me, so of course I felt
wow.
there was something wrong with me. Absolutely.
Okay. Wow. My goodness. Well, despite all of that, you pulled yourself together. You're healthy, happy. And so people out there right now who have that feeling of less than, you know, that there is something, you know, in them that they're just, maybe they're that salmon, you know, running, you know, swimming upstream,
right.
the feeling
mm-hmm.
you know that you had. What was it that you did to overcome that?
Well, I spent a lot of time reflection. I did go into therapy. I did spend time talking about these issues, and I read many self-help books. I took some of my own spiritual journeys in the form of workshops, in the form of retreats. I completed Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way a few times, which really helped me to kind of open myself up and look at the areas of my life that I could strengthen. I'm a voracious reader, so I did a lot of reading and writing. And eventually, my story came out into this book. And I think you'll probably relate to this, because I think when you wrote your first book, Joy Potential, you said that what came to you was just when you took a walk, that's when the ideas came to you. Very much for me, I had to trust the process of writing my story, and I had no idea how it was, the trajectory of the book, or if it was going to be a book. I just wrote what turned into maybe 20 pages, which kind of looked like a chapter, and then I went on, and which became my book, and that in itself really helped me to put myself back together as well.
Well, I must say I am so thrilled that you know, took the time to know a little bit about me, you know, and what I've done, and I'm just really tickled, you know, that you.
Well,
you know,
I was very excited to when you heard that, because when you said that, because I didn't know that other. I always think, again, this is kind of my default thinking, other people do better. I'm thinking that a lot of authors, and some do, they know exactly what the outline of their entire book is. But when you said that you really needed to take a walk and the inspiration showed itself, and in a way maybe it was like you're, you know, getting the exercise or being told. And then when you said that you saw a snake actually shedding its skin, and that was very
right.
Symbolic, like a metaphor of the way in which you were learning. I thought, I am so excited to be interviewed by you today, because that's exactly how I feel too.
Wow, that yeah.
The universe provides metaphors for us and lessons for us.
You know, it does. You know, and it puts before you people in situations that if you're, you know, aware, you know, and open your eyes and are kind of, you know, open to receiving, you know, what those messages are, they can just be so affirming, you know, you know, and like you say, you know, knowing that, you know, there's someone else who followed the same crazy way, you know, that it worked for you. Now, in the introduction, I indicated that you help other people write. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm a writing professor at El Camino College, which is a two-year college in Torrance. And what I find to be especially important, especially for developing writers, these are a lot of students who don't necessarily read a lot or write or don't even like writing or reading, is to help them find their writer's voice. And from their voice, they can learn to write pretty much anything. But we can't really ask them to write about Shakespeare unless they've at least found their own voice in writing about themselves. I love Flannery O'Connor's quote. She said, anybody who has survived childhood has enough information to write a lifetime on. Because a lot of writers, students will say, I have nothing to write about. And I say, well, you're sitting in class, so I know you've survived your childhood. And that's kind of where we focus on. And so that's, to me, a writer's voice is the most important thing to establish. And I hope that I've done that in my book, too.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the guys I remember it very clearly is probably about 4 years ago. I had an intuitive person on the show, and we had a caller in, and she was saying that she wanted to be a writer. She wanted to write, and the person said, well, you know, I see you writing now, and says, yeah, she, you know, does journaling, you know, and she goes, well, you know, write about that, and the woman was flabbergasted. Oh, no, I could absolutely not write about myself. What am I, you know, what would I have to say? Da, 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 da. I mean, she went on and on, and, you know, and it was, and I had to chuckle, because it's like, you know, if ever you want to tell a unique story, tell your story.
Absolutely.
You know,
that's what I tell my students.
absolutely. Well, okay, let's see here. Now, again, thank you very much for knowing a little bit about me. Now, when it comes time to, what do you want your readers to take away from reading When Will I Be Good Enough? What are some of your hopes that will be a result of reading it?
I hope that they'll be able to see that their own life and their own challenges can be used to live a very enriched, full life. And so much about our lives really depends on our attitudes and our perspective. And we can see ourselves as victims, or we can see ourselves as these amazing people with incredible potential, just working through the layers to live a fulfilling life. And I think that's what's really important, because absolutely there are people who have had very hard lives, much harder than I have in many areas, and I acknowledge that. But it's really how we can weave together our challenges to create this beautiful tapestry, as I mentioned. And that's what I hope that the readers will feel comfortable, that they can have that same kind of positive experience in their lives too, despite any challenges that they had. As I tell my own students, the statute of limitations in terms of blaming our parents runs out at 18. So we don't have to blame our parents for anything, because we have our lives that we can create as magnificently as we want them to be.
Yeah, that is real true. As far as living a full life. First of all, when you made a comment about, many people may have had more challenging life experiences. That's the one thing that I am constantly made aware of, with guests on the show, is that some of the challenges some people have gone through, mine don't even come close to the challenges that they've experienced. So that whenever I get myself wrapped up in, my problems, whatever they may be, I take a step back and think, wait a minute, in the scheme of things, this is nothing. This is truly nothing, and recognize that. And, it may be an obstacle. It may be, it's all temporary. It will pass, just get through it and life will go on, it has, as far as, meeting obstacles, meeting challenges, it just makes life easier when you just put it into perspective.
That's right. Absolutely. My grandfather used to say, 50% of what you worry about won't happen, and the other 50% will happen whether you worry about it or not. And so it allows me to kind of let go of a lot of things that I might have anxiety about or thinking about, kind of detaching from that.
Yeah, very much. Well, this has really been a delightful conversation, Barbara. I really wanted to thank you for your time. And I recognize, there is this replacement, child, experience that people go through. But I think a lot of people out there now, I'm sure, will go through and find out more and explore. And I think, it's a great thing that you did to raise awareness about it.
Thank you. And I think, having talked to some people don't even realize that they themselves are replacement children or that they know someone. So it's really, because it's a fairly new phenomena, so in terms of the research. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show. I so appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. And I look forward to it. Now, are you on social media at all?
I'm on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, by the end of the show, at the end of the show, I'm going to connect to you to all three of those, because I do want to stay in touch and be able to follow
you.
Thank you. So I really appreciate your time.
I feel the same way. I've enjoyed this hour so much. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Barbara Jaffe. We have been talking about her book, When Will I Be Good Enough? And it's a replacement child. Oh my goodness, I lost the the title of it, the subtitle of it there. It's a Replacement Child's Journey to Healing. So again, When Will I Be Good Enough? Again, you can find out more about Barbara and her book by visiting her website, which is barbaraandjaffe.com. And again, there is a direct link to Barbara's website in the show page description. And definitely join her on social media, as I will. And I do want to thank you all for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.